clams in Maine. These are tough times for Maine's clam fishery. The 2017 harvest was the lowest since 1930, and the 2018 harvest was only marginally better. Clams face threats on many fronts, including from runoff pollution and from the invasive and widespread green crab, which is a voracious predator of young clams. The number of people who make their living on the flats is declining dramatically. But some communities have begun to fight back and are engaged in creative projects to rebuild the clam fishery. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll learn more about the different kinds of clams in Maine, the threats to a sustainable harvest, and some of the ideas for reversing the decline. We'll also find out what all of us can do to protect Maine's steamers. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Clamming is a vital industry in Maine, but a number of threats have caused a decline in the clam harvest in recent years. Our guest today will talk about the promising research and different approaches that are being used in coastal communities to protect the clam population. Joining me in the studio, Bridie McGreevy. She's Assistant Professor of Environmental Communication at the University of Maine and a faculty fellow in the Mitchell Center for Sustainability Solutions. Marissa McMahon is a senior fisheries scientist at ManoMet, and Glenn Melvin is a longtime clam harvester and member of the Walderboro Shellfish Committee and Maine Shellfish Advisory Council. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about clams? Are you wondering about environmental threats to them? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Bridie, I'm going to start with you, and I'm wondering if you can give us an overview of how important the clam industry is to Maine, not only economically, but also culturally and historically.
Yeah. So Maine's softshell clam fishery is the second or third largest fishery in the state, varies year to year. And it also supplies 60% of the U.S. domestic market for clams. So economically, wow, it's incredibly valuable. Communities across the coast really rely on it as an important source of income and livelihoods. But also culturally, clamming has been occurring on Maine's coasts for literally thousands of years. Wabanaki people relied on clams as well as mussels and oysters. They continue to do so today. It's an important part of the sustenance fishery in the Passamaquoddy tribe at Sabaic. And in the work that I've been doing with clammers over the last couple of years, you know, when I ask clammers about, you know, what do you like about clamming? What kind of memories do you have about clamming? They talk about how important it's been for their families, how this is something that has been, you know, passed down across the generations. And they tell these incredible stories about being out on mud flats and, you know, seeing these amazing things like clams spurting up across at sunrise and, you know, phosphorescent plankton. So it's a really important part of, you know, the cultural fabric. And, you know, one of the challenges is that that fabric is really starting to unravel in ways.
And I'll turn to you for that, Marissa. We've been hearing about the decline, precipitous decline in the clam harvest. It depends what kind of clam you're talking about, correct? It's the steamers or softshell clams that are really in trouble.
Yeah, so the softshell clam has actually been in decline for several years. But even if you kind of look at more of the historic landings of clams in the state and you look back to the 50s or the 70s or the 80s, you know, you can see the landings were in the 20 to 30 millions of pounds a year sort of range. Whereas today we're looking more at like the 6, 7, 8 million pounds of clams a year. So we can see a decline, you know, certainly over a long period of time, but also just in the more recent past, since about 2010 or so, we've seen sort of an incremental decline. And so, you know, there's certainly several factors that influence that. One of those factors is predation, specifically the European green crab has been increasing in abundance, and that's a very voracious predator of softshell clams. So it's really the softshell clam that we're talking about when we think about those declines.
And the hardshell clams, the quahogs and the others in that category are not seeing the same kind of decline, correct?
No. So actually, the hard shell clam, a quahog, is another name for a hard shell clam. So that clam actually is a little bit less susceptible to predation by green crabs. It has a harder shell, of course. You know, you can take that out of the name. So they have a little bit more protection. And so we've actually seen that that species actually ranges throughout the eastern coast of the U.S., so all the way down to Florida, actually. So that species also can really thrive in warm water. And so we're seeing that, you know, as the Gulf of Maine is warming, that's one of the species that is, you know, maybe perhaps benefiting from
okay.
that.
Okay, and that's quahog, cherrystone, topnecks, little necks.
So many names.
Yeah, yeah. So, Glenn, I want to turn to you. I understand you started clamming in 1976.
Scary, isn't it?
I know. I'm looking at you. You must have been a kid.
I was 15.
Yeah. So how has it give us the view from the flats. How has it changed in that time?
That's a good question. Ever since I started, before I started anything, I want to put a big shout out to a guy that he bought new speakers and had a big bowl of popcorn specifically for the show. So I have to say hi to him before I start. So we've always wondered what is the true enemy of the shellfish and the clammers and the whole nine yards, and what can clammers realistically do about this, and how we've evolved through time. We've wondered about acidification. That's what some people claim. That's our biggest enemy. We don't know what to do about it. We can't throw Tums, Rolaids, nothing like that's going to work. We have warming of the waters. We can't dump ice out there. The green crabs, we put out crab traps. We put signs out, no crabs in Waldoboro. They still come in. Milky worms, we don't have an idea what to do with that. Red tide, we still don't have an idea what to do with that. Fecal coliform pollution. That's a huh. That's a well, let's think about this. So we thought this might be something we could easily fix. We wanted to attack this because if a river or a cove is closed to pollution, it doesn't matter what's going on in the mud. We don't care about the green crab or the milky worms or anything else if we don't have access to the mud at all. So Waldoboro decided that that would be the number one enemy that we needed to fight and take on. And we wanted to have results. This isn't something that we were going to try for 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
Glenn, I want to stop you here because it's a lot to unpack right here. And I just want to sort of build into what Waldoboro is doing and sort of back up a little bit and just ask you how it's changed. In 1976, when you were 15 and you were out in the flats, how many people are out there with you? How easy was it to harvest? And what is it like today? Just what is the difference?
It's a totally different game today than it was then. The rules are totally different. We didn't have pollution closures back then. We didn't have 2-inch laws back then. We dug with rat wire in our hods because you could take any size clam that there was. Mm-hmm. We could travel throughout the state. We didn't have town laws. When I started in the early 70s, the Madomic freezes very early, so she'd freeze up tight. We'd go to Thomaston then because the river flowed faster. Once Thomaston froze, we went to Wiscasset, because they had this thing on there called a nuclear plant, and it kept the water warm, so it didn't freeze. So we could dig clams even in the coldest part of the year over in Wiscasset. And nuclear plant's gone now, and we have town laws, so I can't travel like I did. So comparing numbers for me is deceiving. It's not the
it's
same thing.
It's just an entirely different world.
Yes, it is.
And you know what strikes me, talking to you, Glenn, and reading about this topic, is with so many of the fisheries issues, we're talking about perhaps overfishing. That's not the case when we're talking about the problems with the clam fishery, is it? We're talking about pollution. We're talking about predation from green crabs. We're talking about, talking about a kind of a white worm?
Yeah, milky worm, they call
milky
it.
Milky worm.
We don't have it in Waldoboro, but other rivers too.
So you're talking about things that are all external. It's not the clammers who've caused this.
We had 6,000 clammers in the 80s. We have 1,500 to 1,600 now. I don't know how you could get to overfishing with those numbers.
Right, right. And I think that's a really important point. So let's unravel what some of these threats are. We all know about green crabs. We've heard about green crabs. We also know that the waters are warming in the Gulf of Maine. And Marissa, I'm going to turn to you. Green crabs love warm water, right? And if somebody hasn't been on the waterfront recently and hasn't sort of been tide pooling or had their ankles in the water. What is the difference in the number of green crabs now than there were even 5 years ago?
Well, I will just preface what I'm going to say with, the fact that it's very much dynamic and it can change from one cove to the next. And
okay.
So actually, right before the show, Glenn and I were talking about how where he is, they actually have fewer green crabs than they had probably 5 years ago. It does change, but I would say the overall trend that we have seen is that they are increasing and they do seem to be thriving in warm water.
And the reason we're talking about green crabs is because green crabs eat baby clams.
Yes, they actually can eat just about any size clam. The clam doesn't really have much natural protection because their shell is so soft and brittle. The crab can actually, larger crabs can crush through an adult size clam pretty easily.
And I read as many as 40 a day.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, that seems like such a difficult thing to do. And that gets to one of the things you mentioned earlier, Glenn. You've tried all sorts of things. And one of those is creating some sort of fencing or something, right?
Our Waldeboro didn't, but there are rivers that have tried fencing.
How does that work?
It blow right through them. You can't fence them out. You can trap them. If they're thick enough, you can trap and trap and trap and get the same amount one day that you did the last day. If you've got the green crabs, you're not going to the we know of as of now, get rid of them until Mother Nature takes them away.
So, Bridie, you've been learning about clams, learning about all these threats to them, and you are sort of coordinating a big project that Glenn is part of, many communities trying to figure out what can we do. What are some of the creative solutions that different towns on the main coast are doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so an important part of this context is that the softshell clam resource is managed in a system that's known as co-management, which is a shared responsibility between the towns, the 74 towns who have a municipal ordinance, and the state of Maine. And one of the opportunities in co-management is that it just creates a space where people can come together and talk about what's going on, what are the problems, how can we work together to address these issues. And it's a space that might not otherwise exist in these municipalities. So it's in the context of co-management that we're seeing people come together to try out and advance the water quality efforts that Glenn was mentioning, of doing different kinds of seeding efforts and bringing in other species like quahogs, trying to recruit clams and understand the differences in where clams settle out on the mudflat and where they grow best so that they can more effectively focus their conservation efforts. And over the last year, we have partnered with the Broadreach Fund of the Maine Community Foundation. Their grants coordinator, Andrea Perry, had been, learning more about co-management and talking with a whole bunch of people over the last couple of years and wanted to harness this opportunity that she was seeing in the co-management system to support these kinds of projects that are going on.
Okay, and one of those projects is the Waldeboro Project. Glenn, what did you all focus on? How did you sort of get your heads around how we can try to make progress? What can we do? You started with not green crabs, but pollution.
Right. And I think the thing that we have to clarify here is we're talking about two different projects. Mm-hmm. The Madomic Project started back in 2012, which
okay.
is what I was headed towards.
Okay.
The Resilience Project, which Bridie just came about in the past year or so, we took on in a different
okay,
avenue
good.
Than we did.
Okay, so
before
starting
that.
In 2012, what was your aha moment?
Yeah. My aha moment was that the fact that the river itself was talking about being closed. Waldeboro has over 150 diggers. We're the largest in the state. We have the largest harvest in the state. We're the number one river by average. On the last 8 years, we were over 100,000 pounds of a second place. It's Waldeboro's number one employer. And it was becoming very heavily polluted, and we didn't know what to do about it. So we took on and created what was called the Madomic Project, and that's where I was before. Attacking fecal coliform, we feel, is the only thing that can be productive. We don't see a way to defeat the green crab or red tide or acidification or any of that stuff.
Fecal coliform, sewage.
Yes. Yes, from any warm-blooded animal, birds, deer, beavers, humans, the whole nine yards. And that was our biggest enemy at the time. And like I said, it doesn't matter the rest of the stuff, what's going on in the mud, if we can't get there. If they close the river, I don't care if we have green crabs or if we have milky worms or if we have acidification, because I can't get there anyway. So we believe that the number one enemy is pollution, because you have to have a river to start with. So if you don't have a river to start with, then everything else is quite irrelevant. So for us, it was pollution, and that's what we took on and started in 2012. We started the task force, which was composed of a group of very smart, ambitious people. Phil Garwood works for the Department of Environmental Protection. He was the captain of the project. He made sure it happened. He was definitely the hardest worker on the project. He did the literature. He walked all over the town. He's known as a legend in the town just because of the success of the project, which I can tell you about when we get done. Cole Kinwit, Department of Marine Resources. She knew what it took to make this happen and gave us the ingredients to make this project as large as it was to actually go through a town. She deserves a lot of credit, mainly because she deals with me. I have days that I don't like dealing with me, and I don't mind the voices in my head. I hate it when they argue, and I hate it when they throw things.
But I want to ask you, Glenn, I appreciate that you want to give credit to those involved, but we're getting close to a break. Tell us what you all did. I understand one of the things you did was put smoke bombs into sewage pipes.
Yes, and I have to give credit. This has been 5 years that we've done this, and I'm the one that gets the awards. I'm the one that speaks on the radio, and that's not fair.
I understand.
So I will, before this is done, give proper credits to the proper people. And yes, I can tell you some of the stuff we did. We went house to house, wandered through every house in the town.
Really?
Every house in the town. Checked the sewer system, checked to see if it had leaks. We smoke bombed the streets. We hired pollution sniffing dogs at $2,500 a day. We then got the dogs all off our landings. We tried to exclude all animals from the river itself in case that was causing the pollution. We did DNA testing at UNH. We are now mapping the river currents with a lady named Gabby Hillier. And as a matter of fact, they're working on it right now while I'm up here. And Dr. Lauren Ross is mapping the currents, too. We figure if we understand the currents of the river, then maybe we could understand the flow of the pollution.
And have you been able to clean the water? I mean, are the flats open more than they were?
We've opened up. Originally, we started, we just wanted to stop it from being any more polluted. So that was the original goal. And it actually went past that, and we opened up almost 400 acres of clam flats.
Variety, what can other communities learn from what happened in Waldoboro?
Well, I think the Waldoboro case has really been an important example of inspiring these other towns. So in the Maine Shellfish Restoration and Resilience Project, we had 9 communities trying to do what they did in Waldoboro, because the pollution problems that they were facing in that river are pollution problems that we see across the coast. What Glenn's describing of having a coalition of people to come together, where you have good representation from the town, from the harvester community, from DEP, DMR, all working together to figure out what is the problem here and what do we do about it, through collaboration, is absolutely essential, as is multiple forms of leadership. Everybody can play a different kind of role, and that has been a key factor, I think, in the success of Madomic.
All right. Well, we do have to take a quick break. We're talking about the clam harvest in Maine. Your comments and questions on Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Apple Acres Farm in Cornish, Maine. With you pick organic fruit, lunch, cider donuts, gifts, and more. AppleAcresFarm.com. And Gracie Theater's Women of the World on October 13th, a celebration of diversity and the power of music. GracieTheater.com.
On the next Fresh Air, when you recycle plastics and paper, are you unknowingly contaminating the recycling by including things you shouldn't? Where does your recycling really end up now that China is no longer accepting it? And what about e-waste, your computers and devices? We'll talk with Kate O'Neill, author of Waste. Join us.
That's coming up this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. More than 170 news outlets from around the world, including both NPR and Maine Public News, are taking part in Covering Climate Now, leading up to the United Nations Climate Action Summit in New York on September 23rd. Participating organizations will report on climate news and issues and provide useful background information throughout the week, more than usual, starting next week. Here on Maine Public, you'll hear the reporting on Morning Edition, Here and Now, All Things Considered, and a Maine Calling program next Friday looking at sea level rise. More information is at mainepublic.org/climatenow.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we're talking about clams and what can be done to improve the health of their population in Maine. Joining me, Marissa McMahon, senior fisheries scientist at Mano Met; Glenn Melvin, a clammer and member of the Walderboro Shellfish Committee and Maine Shellfish Advisory Council; and Bridie McGreevy, a UMaine assistant professor of environmental communication. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I want to bring you into the conversation, Marissa, the biologist here. The problem that they really tackled hard in Walderboro, the pollution, the runoff, is that the biggest threat? Is that the big one thing that if towns could upgrade their sewage systems, figure out how to control runoff, et cetera, would that make a big difference?
I think it's certainly one of the bigger impacts that we've seen. And again, you know, we're talking about a very dynamic system. So it changes from, you know, one town to the next, one cove to the next. But I do think, like Glenn was saying, you know, a lot of these problems, there's not a whole lot that can be done necessarily, or certainly in the very near future. And so picking the problems that you can address and can do something about is a really smart way to go about trying to, you know, have an impact on this resource. You know, it's interesting because, you know, there's other towns. I work a lot in Georgetown, for instance, and they don't necessarily deal with as much of a pollution problem. Instead, for them, it's really about just diversification. And so that's kind of what that town has really targeted as what they can do to try and help their clam diggers.
You say diversification, introducing different varieties of clams?
Yeah. So in Georgetown, unlike a lot of other surrounding areas and towns, the only resource that they have in Georgetown is the softshell clam. Whereas some other areas, Brunswick, Harpswell, West Bath, further south, have also the hardshell clam. And so they're able to actually, when their softshell clam resource is in decline, you know, move over and start harvesting a different species. And so in Georgetown, one of the things as part of the Broadreach program with funding from Broadreach, their shellfish committee has really decided that trying to diversify resources is the best way that they can spend their time. And so they have started to introduce quahogs or sort of reintroduce quahogs into Georgetown and try and really build up that population so that they have another resource besides just the softshell clam.
All right. Well, on the line with us now is Brian Beal, who is professor of marine ecology at the University of Maine in Machias and director of research at Down East Institute. Thanks for calling in, Brian.
How are you today?
I'm great. Tell us about your research about what's harming the clam population.
Well, from the perspective of the resource, probably predation with green crabs, it's an old story, is probably the number one threat. You can have clean water. You can clean up rivers. But that doesn't put clams on flats. That only allows clams to be dug. So my research is taking a look at how to make flats more productive over time, independent of fecal coliforms.
How does this affect the management of how clams are harvested?
Well, it depends. I mean, so my work is in the public domain, and it's noticed by folks in the Department of Marine Resources as well as by, you know, towns and community officials. And so they're able to use whatever it is that I can find if they wish, or they can ignore it if they wish. But you know, basically what I'm trying to do is to find ways to put more clams on flats so that clammers can make a better living.
So not trying to get rid of the green crabs, but basically say the more clams there are, the more chance that more will survive.
Exactly. There's no getting rid of the green crabs. They've been here in Maine since 1905, And as Glenn and others have said, their populations really are going to ebb and wane with weather rather than with biology. Most people don't realize that everything eats green crabs, fish, green crabs, lobsters, ducks, all kinds of things eat green crabs, but nothing can keep up with their populations because they're just so so fecund. They produce so many eggs and so many larvae that there's nothing out there that really can keep them in check, other than lots and lots of ice. So if we have cold winters, and that's what we should all be hoping for, that will certainly reverse the trend of green crabs.
We have an email from a Marissa with a question for you, Dr. Beal. And this is a different Marissa than the Marissa in the studio with me.
Yeah.
She asks, in the face of such overwhelming ecological evidence that the cause is not human predation but green crabs, what can be done to protect clams from predators in order to sustain the soft shell clam fishery?
Well, that's a great question. I'd say that within the last 6 or 7 years, it's been something that I've really thought a lot about, given the results of the research that I've been doing, which incidentally, and just since 2013, the folks who helped me at DEI and the clammers that I've been working with up and down, around the state, we've worked in 149 different coves in 21 coastal communities. And in Freeport since 2013, we have done experiments where we have actually had to pour through and sieve through 4.65 tons of mud, pushing that through, washing that through 1-millimeter screens. So, you know, we've collected an awful lot of data. And, you know, I essentially have four different things that I can think of that, you know, I think that it could help. And that's the design. And it needs to be thought of in a broad term rather than just simply the town of Waldoboro or Freeport or Jonesport. And one of them is taking a look at, you know, first of all, where did the 2-inch clam law come from? And so, you know, when I look at the landings that Marissa and others have referred to, the 2-inch clam law was instated in around 1985. And if you follow the clam landings of the state from 1985 to 2018, it's kind of really level or it's declining. And so the 2-inch clam law that a lot of people think, since it's been instated for over 30 years, they think it's a biological tool or a biological mechanism that is helpful to management. And it really isn't. It's independent. It was instated because Massachusetts decided to go for a 2-inch clam law, and dealers could not sell clams in Massachusetts if they were less than 2 inches. So that was imposed. And so I'm trying to find out from the work that we've done how we can put more clams outside of a hatchery just naturally onto flats. And one of the ways to do it is to essentially allow clams to spawn and put more spawners out there. So you know, in looking at that, we know that there's a 5-inch maximum for lobsters in the state of Maine. And when I go around and ask people if they understand why that is, they all tell me, yeah, because the large lobsters are the spawners. Well, it's the same thing for urchins. It's the same thing for oysters. It's the same thing for softshell clams. So why not put an upper limit on softshell clams and leave the ones that are in the flats that are old and that are spawning, that produce a lot more eggs and sperm, let's leave them there. No one really wants to eat a 3.5-inch clam and larger. In fact, when I go into dealers' places along the coast, I always find signs that say we're not buying honkers today, meaning that they really don't want to buy the large clams. It's just, you know, they're hard to sell in most instances. And since they reproduce so immensely, let's just leave them there. So I'd like to see an upper size limit put on clams that would hopefully put more clams on flats.
Okay.
On the other hand, there's clam spawn as a result of as a result of increasing water temperature. So every year there's a seasonal clam spawning, no matter where you are on the coast. And typically, clams spawn at temperatures that start at around 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you look at, you know, Kittery, and you go up to Rockland, and then you go to Searsport, and then you go down to Lubeck, you kind of have a difference in how soon the seawater temperatures warm up to 50 degrees. So perhaps if we thought about leaving clams alone to let them spawn for a couple of weeks in different regions of the state, depending on water temperature, I call that rolling closures to allow more clams to spawn. That might be a mechanism to put more clams on flats.
Okay, well, thank you, Brian. So many ideas. Brian Beal, a professor of marine ecology at UMaine, Machias, director of research at the Downing Institute. Brian Beal putting out some proposals there. What I've learned in reading about this, though, almost everything's controversial. Yes? Almost all big proposals. You're all smiling and nodding. Who wants to jump in? There's pros and cons to all of them.
Yeah, so I think one thing to note is that in some circles, 2019 has come to be known as the year of the intertidal in the state legislature. There were about a dozen bills that were put forward that were advancing some important ideas, some related to the ideas that Dr. Beal just shared. And very few of these passed or even made it out of committee, in part because of the controversy. So in terms of the rolling closure, one of the things that came up as people were talking about this publicly is that if you have rolling closures starting in the southern part of the state in, you know, mid to late May, as they roll out across the coast and you start to have closures in down East Maine in late June and July, that coincides with typically higher prices for clams. And so it can create a disparate impact on down East communities. There may be ways to adjust for that, but that's a source of some of the controversy. And it goes to some of the complexity in you know, what's going on.
That's what I was
going
to say, an example of how complicated some of this is. We'll go to Trish, who's calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Trish. Go ahead.
Hi. As a person who lives on the coast, is there anything we can do at a community level to limit runoff from things like pesticides or lawn treatments? Does it have any effect on clamming or other fishing? And are municipalities allowed to make regulations, or is there some larger body that has to approve putting in local ordinances like that?
Great question, Trish. And I'm going to add to her. She said, as far as herbicides or pesticides, but generally, what can communities and individuals do to help?
Mine. Probably the best thing you can do is, if you do think you have runoff, try to get it to go through a buffer zone. A buffer zone of vegetation, something like that. Try to keep it, if you can, from going into the river. One thing you have to realize is that just because you don't live on the river doesn't mean you don't go to the river. And that's what we learned in the Madomic Project. If a stream goes by your house, then it goes to the river. So anything you can do to stop it, from picking up after your dog to using pesticides in the best way you can, would obviously help us.
I would just add, too, I think just sort of general outreach and education and awareness really helps. And there's been examples, for instance, there was an example in Georgetown of a whole area, a whole bay that was closed, and it was because of a sort of grandfathered historic overboard discharge. And that was, I believe, if I'm getting the facts right, was really just due to one property that had an old outhouse on it that was no longer functioning or in use, but because that was there and because it had been sort of grandfathered and they had had that closure, that actually closed all of the flats surrounding that area. And so it was a simple matter of just finding the folks who owned that property, having them remove that, and then, you know, going through the paperwork of being able to remove that closure. So, you know, simple kind of things like that that you don't normally think about, or, you know, you don't expect might be having a huge impact, you know, actually can.
All right. Thanks, Trish. We have an email from the Maine Clammers Association. The efforts to address issues of water quality in Waldoboro are commendable and obviously very important. That being said, can the panel shed some light on the reasons why, after the opening of 360 acres, nearly a third of Waldoboro's mudflats, the annual catch of shell clams dropped so dramatically in 1 year?
Yeah. Life is a sine wave. Waldoboro is number one on average over 8 years by 100,000 pounds, as I said. But we're not number one every year. This is called fishing, not catching. When you catch fish, you don't sequentially go up every year. One tomorrow, two the next day, three the next day, four the next day, five the next day. This is Mother Nature you're dealing with. And Waldeboro has always had great harvest, and we've had years when we had not so great harvest. It's typical.
A question from John. Sea duck hens eat green crabs. I think most people on the coast watch sea duck hens hatch out ducklings that get gobbled up by black-back gulls. If laws could change so that people could eliminate black-backed gulls, then that would help control the green crab population.
I actually just as frequently see seagulls eating green crabs as I see ducks eating green crabs. So I'm not entirely sure that that, I mean, Brian was saying, everything eats green crabs. It's not necessarily a lack of predators that is allowing this population to explode.
We're going to take another quick break. If you'd like to ask a question about clams, clam harvesting, green crabs, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You might be able to sneak in a quick email as well at talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And Martins Point Healthcare, dedicated to providing the highest quality care and coverage to the people of Maine, offering Generations Advantage Medicare plans. Learn how you can enroll at generationsadvantage.com.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Dr. B.J. Miller talks to Pico Iyer about our attitudes towards death, the awesome power of grief, and how we might achieve a more human-centered healthcare system. Miller is co-author of A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Facing Death and Living Life. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
Join us this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. Are you a regular listener to Morning Edition? When you miss it, do you wish there was some way you could still hear it, even if it's not on the radio? Well, now you can if you have an Alexa smart speaker. Just say, "Smart speaker, please play Morning Edition." Alexa will then ask you which station you want to hear, and you, of course, will say Maine Public Radio, and then Alexa will play back the last full hour of Morning Edition. So you can hear the most recent hour of Morning Edition with Erwin Gratz until 3 each afternoon. At this point in time, this is for only Alexa smart speakers, but we'll let you know if Google Home learns how to do this. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, all about clams and how to improve the harvest in Maine. Joining me, Glenn Melvin, a longtime clammer, Bridie McGreevy, UMaine professor, and Marissa McMahon with ManoMet. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Marissa, we hear a lot about farming of other species, oyster farming, mussel farming. Is there clam farming?
There is, actually. So ManoMet's actually been working on sort of looking at the viability of softshell clam farming since about 2015. And that work really started from a partnership with a local clam digger in Georgetown named Chris Warner, who was, you know, interested in this idea. And essentially, the idea is that you are you're going out to a section of flats and generally an area that often the clammers refer to as dead mud, where there aren't any clams currently living and growing. And you actually dig plots, you seed those plots with baby clams that you buy from a hatchery, and then you cover those seed clams over with a net. And the net is meant to protect those clams from green crab predation. And so we've been doing this on a commercial scale at several different places, Georgetown, Arousic, Brunswick, Scarborough, and Chabig Island, to really test the viability of this technique to really farm clams. And what we're seeing is that there's sort of mixed results. It's ongoing research. We haven't yet found a way to make this type of farming economically viable. It really, you know, you have to put a certain number of clams under the net and be able to take a certain number out from underneath that net 2 to 3 years later once they've grown and reached harvestable size. So we're still looking into this. We also have found that the milky ribbon worms can be an issue because a net does not protect against milky ribbon worm predation. And so where we've installed these farms and there's a lot of milky ribbon worms, we've actually seen the farms fail. where there's not milky ribbon worms, though, we've had cess. We can, you know, we see from our experiments that these nets do, in fact, protect clams from green crab predation, and the clams survive and they grow and you can harvest them. So it's just, you know, a matter of thinking about how best to sort of use this tool. And so, interestingly, some of the towns we've worked with have really wanted to install a softshell clam farm to, you know, either support the community in terms of a shared resource, for instance, on Chibig Island, a shared resource for recreational clam diggers. In Scarborough, they were doing it as a shared resource for commercial harvesters. And then in Georgetown, I think it's really interesting, their clam farm has really sort of morphed into an outdoor classroom for the local elementary school that can come and learn about clam digging and, you know, clam farming and the biology of clams. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways that you can sort of utilize this clam farming.
Bridie, a lot of people look at the dollar amount and the decrease in the clam landings and say that must be directly correlated to the decrease in population. If the clam landings have gone from $20 million a year to $6 million a year, does that mean there's about a quarter as many clams? And the answer is no, right?
Well, it's in some ways a reliable measure that there's a relationship between clam landings and clam populations. It makes sense that if we're seeing declines in clam landings, the weight of clams brought to market and sold every year, it's related to just a general lack of clams. It's harder to find clams, so there are fewer that are coming onto market. And certainly there's research that's been done. Dr. Beal's work has developed a lot of evidence that there is statewide declines in clam populations. But one of the issues is that we don't actually have statewide stock assessments for clams. This is a major data gap. And there are other influences that can come into play in the decline in clam landings. One of these is market uncertainty. There is a lot of variation in the day-to-day and week-to-week clam prices. They can go from $3.50 a pound to $1, $1.50 overnight. And Glenn, I'm sure, can talk about this much more than I can. And so it becomes increasingly difficult to rely on clamming as a source of income.
So with lower prices, fewer people actually out on the flats.
Exactly.
And fewer clams coming
into market, right? So it just compounds the challenges that we're also seeing with the clam populations.
We'll go to Michael, who's calling from Freeport. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes. Just wanted to make a comment, I guess. I've done some research and done some trapping with green crab and some field work with Brian Beal and the MCA. And although trapping of the green crab is probably good, I guess, but the big concern I have is the little ones that go out through the mesh, the thousands of small ones that that you can't catch. Those are the ones that I feel are doing the most damage. And I think, I don't know what we're going to do. I guess there's no way to get rid of them. But
The little ones, you're talking about the little green crabs that are going through the netting that you're putting out there?
Well, they're about the size of a head of a match. And in Freeport now we're seeing those because we've had an increase in seed. We've had a good set of seed this year. So this time of year, the seed is showing up and so aren't these small green crabs. So we've had an influx of these this year, more than we have in the last couple of years. They've moved off and now they're back again. So
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, that's a big concern. Although, the big ones, have decreased, which they will be back, I'm sure. But, so that's a big concern. I guess I don't know what the doctors can do about it. Dr. Beal didn't seem to think there was much we could do, and I guess the rest of the panel doesn't think so either. But.
Marissa?
That certainly is a very tricky situation. That size is, you can't trap crabs that are that size. And so how do you get rid of them? And I probably have to agree with Dr. Beal that there's really not a whole lot that can be done with that size range of crabs. I would say that one of the things that we've really tried to do now is actually think about, ways that we can utilize and benefit from green crabs. If they're here and they're here to stay, is there something that we can do with them to actually benefit? And so that, clam diggers can benefit, or lobster fishermen, or any fisherman. And so developing markets and products for green crabs has been one of the real focuses of my work in the recent past. And we've made some, you know, advances in that arena and have really, you know, started to crack the nut in terms of what it is that people would want for products. So we're working on developing softshell crab fisheries and other fisheries that would utilize crabs for bait markets or for compost or fertilizer. So there's a whole host of ways that we can use green crabs and benefit from them. And so, you know, I mean, I really try to, you know, emphasize that when talking with folks instead of just emphasizing, you know, that there's not necessarily anything we can do to reduce the population. Instead, I feel like we should be kind of thinking about what we can do to benefit from that population.
Michael, thanks for your call. We'll go to David calling from York. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you? I am calling in reference to hen clams. When we have beautiful winter storms here at Long Sands in New York, we have an amazing, you know, harvest of hen clams. And I called the fishery department before and been told that I cannot harvest those. Is that true?
Does anyone know about?
My understanding, but I, before I even say this, I would point you to the Maine Department of Marine Resources, as a starting point, their website that would give you information about the regulations. But my understanding of this is that there are seasonal closures for hen clams, and that they're a precautionary closure so that they're not doing sampling that would kind of determine whether or not it's safe to eat hen clams.
Okay.
But again, it's really important to go to the source for any kind of water quality information.
Okay. And hen clams are the same as Atlantic surf clams, and they're a hard shell clam, not a soft shell clam, correct?
Right. And they're huge. They're really big. I didn't know this. I went out hen clamming with my good friend Jim Norris, and he'd been talking about these. I'd never seen them before. And then, you know, they're whoppers. They're really big.
David, thanks for your call. Glenn, do you harvest only softshell clams or do you do both?
No, just softshell.
Okay. And is that because you're in Waldorboro or because people tend to have a specialty?
No, that's because I'm in Waldorboro. That's all we have.
Okay. There. Okay. We have a question from Lynn. Maine clams are suffering from the depletion of calcium in their shells. So the shells of today's clams are 50% thinner than those of the 1950s. I have proposed to our state legislators that they enact a bill which require Maine restaurants collect all the seafood shells from their businesses and have them spread on the clam flats to replenish the calcium in the environment. This could be augmented by the collection of shells from residents at transfer stations. I read that a Kennebunkport restaurant was actually fined in 2013 for doing this. Perhaps some procedures for grinding the shells up first is required. Marissa, have you heard about this idea of trying to get more calcium into clam shells?
I have heard of similar programs to that in other states that have been operating. I would say that, you know, putting those shells back out into the environment does, you know, they break down and that releases calcium carbonate into the water. And so, you know, it might be a way to locally provide an influx of calcium into the water. And, you know, the real issue with anything that is a calcifying organism not being able to build a stronger shell is really, we're talking about ocean acidification and, you know, the pH level of the water.
Which is another threat we really haven't talked about much this hour, but is a real threat to clams.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It certainly is. You know, as the water acidifies, it becomes harder and harder for any organism that needs to build a shell. It becomes harder for them to do it. And so, yeah, so, I mean, there's definitely projects that have utilized sort of like shell recycling programs. I've seen it in other states with oysters has become a very sort of popular thing going around from, you know, restaurant to restaurant or business to business and collecting their old oyster shells and then putting those back out into the environment. So I can't really speak as to the actual impact of that. I've never really studied it, but it does happen in places.
Glenn, I want to ask you about the future. Where do you see the future of clam harvesting, the clam industry, the clam fishery in Maine?
I think it's a moving target just because I've seen it from start from the 70s and come to where it is now. So that's a good question as to where we're going to end up when it's all done, said and done. I don't have an answer for you as to where we're headed and how we're going to get there or anything like that.
Is there a crop of young clammers or is the whole clam digging population aging?
Yeah, it looks like we're dinosaurs. I believe the average age is about 54 or 52 or something like that. Society's changed. Everything has changed, and the decline of the clam digger itself has gone with it. There are a lot more factors than just one answer. There's no one solution that's going to solve this whole problem. And every river has its own demon that it has to fight. And that was the beauty of the Resilience Project, was it gave money to each river to let them fight the way that they wanted to fight and deal with the issues that they had in that river. So it's going to be interesting to watch.
Can a young person, an 18-year-old, a 20-year-old, listening to this program and asking themselves, can I make a living clamming? What's your answer to them?
No, you cannot make a complete living clamming. I have a couple extra jobs. Most people do. Most people's spouse works. It's a different game than it used to be. As I said, back in the 70s, when more people did this as a living, look at all the difference. We didn't have closures back then. We didn't have size limits on clams. We could travel throughout the state. So if your river was down right now, I could go to Thomaston or Damariscotta and dig their river. So moving around used to be a big thing. And all that's gone now. It's apples and oranges. And that's, you have to remember that when you compare the numbers. You take numbers out of the 70s with 6,000, 8,000 clammers and a totally different set of rules, and you try to use them with today's reference, and it's not the same thing. A lot of people do that to prove their point or justify their position, and that's not a true statement at all.
So it's really hard to figure out what's going on, what the real numbers are.
Yes.
The real figures that matter are.
I have read in some magazines of some people trying to get attention of numbers of 38,000. That's the highest year we've ever had. You can't compare anything to the best year you've ever had. I averaged the last 60 years, and the average haul for Maine's 15.3 million pounds. That's a totally different number and would look totally different in an article than the big scare of 37 million pounds. So you have to take everything in perspective and realize who you're talking to. Make sure you deal with people from the industry, not people outside the industry.
Okay, and we just have a few seconds left, but Glenn, tell me why you stick with it.
That's a good question. Clamming's addicting. You only work 3-4 hours a day. And that's tough to get past because the time off is so good. I got to spend a lot of time with my family and raise my family, and that was a big deal for me. And I've gone too far now to turn back, I guess.
Okay. Well, thank you, all three of you, for being in the studio with me today. The voice you just heard, Glenn Melvin, who's a longtime clam harvester and member of the Waldoboro Shellfish Committee and Maine Shellfish Advisory Council. Marissa McMahon is also here, a senior fisheries scientist at ManoMet, and Bridie McGreevy, assistant professor of environmental communication at UMaine and a faculty fellow in the Mitchell Center for Sustainability Solutions. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Special thanks to Fred Bever for helping us with this program. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.